Here's a puzzle. How did Goldman Sachs employees become among the most productive in the world just months after their company helped trigger the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression? Lloyd Blankfein's audacious 2009 claim wasn't just corporate spin. It revealed something profound about how we've come to measure worth in modern economies. His bank had just received a $125 billion government bailout, yet somehow generated $63 billion in profits while laying off thousands. This wasn't productivity in any meaningful sense, yet our economic metrics validated it. We've arrived at a dangerous place, where extracting wealth has become indistinguishable from creating it, where price determines value rather than value determining price. Understanding this shift isn't just an academic exercise. It shapes who gets rewarded, what activities flourish, and whether our economy serves society or merely concentrates wealth. For centuries, economists debated what makes something valuable. Classical thinkers believed value came from production, particularly labor. By the mid-19th century, this shifted. Things became worth whatever people would pay. Value no longer determined price. Price determined value. This reversal conveniently justified capitalists' growing economic share. When value equals price, any activity can be labeled productive without scrutiny. Pharmaceutical companies charge $84,000 for hepatitis C treatments, costing $136 to manufacture, claiming prices reflect intrinsic value. The logic becomes circular. You earn income because you're productive, and you're productive because you earn income. Between 1975 and 2015, U.S. GDP tripled and productivity grew 60%, yet real wages stagnated. Mark Zuckerberg's fortune increased $18 billion in a single year. Without distinguishing value creation from extraction, we can't challenge these outcomes. Economists call this the production boundary, an invisible line separating genuine wealth creators from extractors. Consider Apple's tax arrangements. Despite Ireland's 12.5% corporate tax rate, Apple paid just 0.005% in 2014 through paper subsidiaries existing nowhere. The European Commission ordered Apple to pay $13 billion in back taxes. These aren't value-creating innovations. They're sophisticated extraction mechanisms our current framework struggles to identify. Adam Smith's 1776 pin factory showed 10 specialized workers producing 48,000 pins daily versus 20 individually grounding his value theory in tangible production. Smith drew sharp lines. Material goods were productive, services weren't. David Ricardo refined this. Industrial capitalists enabling worker subsistence while generating reinvestable surplus were heroes. Landed nobility extracting rents were villains. Karl Marx sharpened it further. Production capital directly creates surplus value, while commercial and financial capital extract portions through sales and interest. The late 19th century marginalist revolution, led by Walras, Jevons, and Menger, fundamentally redefined productivity by shifting focus from objective production costs to subjective consumer utility. Only activities fetching legal market prices counted as productive. The productive-unproductive distinction effectively vanished. Nearly all market-exchanged products became productive by definition. In this equilibrium, everyone supposedly earns their worth. Workers receive their marginal productivity. Unemployment becomes rational choice. Exploitation disappears, replaced by the notion that wages and profits are just rewards for productive contributions. GDP drives economic policy, yet it's built on shaky ground. Following marginalist thinking, it includes anything with a legal market price, assuming high salaries signal productivity. But what if income reflects extraction, not creation? Then GDP becomes dangerously misleading. National accounts contain bizarre quirks. They don't distinguish costs from investments like R&D. Valuable unpaid care work stays invisible. If neighbors paid each other for housework, GDP would rise, though nothing real changed. Meanwhile, accountants impute rental values for owner-occupied housing, adding roughly $1 trillion to U.S. GDP despite zero actual transactions. The glaring weakness, confusing profits with rents. Classical theory separated earned income from productive work and unearned income from extraction. Under marginal utility theory, landlords and hedge fund managers are treated as productive contributors, transforming extraction into creation. Government consistently represents 11 to 15% of U.S. GDP, larger than finance. Yet it's measured by inputs equal outputs with no profit margin, making it seem unproductive in a system where profit equals productivity. Finance's contribution uses financial intermediation services indirectly measured, calculated by markups banks charge above reference rates. This transformed what was once considered deadweight cost into added value. Paradoxically, riskier lending and wider spreads increase banks' measured GDP contribution, even when these practices harm the economy. For centuries, finance was viewed as extractive rather than productive, a judgment reflected in the medieval church's ban on interest. This understanding collapsed as financial trading vastly outgrew trade in real products. By 2014, shadow banking, unregulated financial intermediaries, had grown to $80 trillion globally, potentially a quarter of the financial system. Together with deregulated traditional banking, these forces created a disproportionately large financial sector, largely serving itself. Only 15% of generated funds go to non-financial businesses. Finance extracts value through transaction costs, monopoly power, and high fees relative to risks taken. Despite technological advances, financial intermediation costs barely fell over the past century. John Bogle demonstrated how active fund management fees, averaging 2.27%, dramatically reduce returns through the tyranny of compounding costs. Over 40 years, these fees can slash final returns by 40%, turning a potential $165,000 retirement fund into just $100,000. Hedge funds exemplify extraction through their 2-and-20 structure, 2% of assets plus 20% of profits, despite mediocre performance. Between 2003 and 2012, 449 S&P 500 companies spent $2.4 trillion, 54% of earnings, on share buybacks, with another 37% on dividends. Just 9% remained for capital investment. The 10 largest repurchasers spent $859 billion, with 7 committing over 100% of net income to buybacks and dividends. This isn't value creation. It's systematic extraction enabled by the maximizing shareholder value doctrine. Buybacks differ crucially from dividends. While dividends distribute evenly to all shareholders, buybacks reward only those selling shares while automatically boosting earnings per share, a key metric determining executive compensation. This creates perverse incentives, catalyzing short-termism, outsourcing, and job losses. Keynes warned in the 1930s that stock markets would become a battle of wits to anticipate conventional valuation a few months hence. Equity holding periods plummeted from 4 years in 1945 to 22 seconds by 2011 with high-frequency trading. Quarterly performance pressure leads companies to maintain artificially high hurdle rates, 18% median for S&P 500 companies, despite only 8.5% weighted cost of capital, causing them to forego viable long-term investments for share repurchases. The resulting underinvestment suppresses productivity, wages, and domestic demand. We stand at a crossroads. The 2008 crisis exposed how modern capitalism rewards rent seekers over wealth creators, speculation over production. Redefining value means recognizing markets aren't autonomous. They're shaped by society, with government policy co-creating rather than intervening. Economic direction matters more than growth rates. GDP and fiscal probity are crude targets. The real question is how spending creates long-term value. Mission-oriented approaches like Apollo built in-house capacity and fostered collaboration. The public sector's crucial role in innovation, from the internet to GPS to breakthrough drugs, demands recognition and reward structures ensuring collective benefits. Value must reclaim its central place in economic thinking. We must decide what economy we want, fulfilling jobs, less pollution, better care, equal pay, and shape activities accordingly. This requires distinguishing wealth creation from extraction, innovation serving society from financial engineering concentrating wealth. The choice is moral. Will extraction continue masquerading as creation, or will we rebuild an economy rewarding genuine contribution? If we reclaim this conversation, we might build an economy that creates rather than extracts, serves rather than dominates. The tools exist. What's needed is collective will.